We are doing a deep dive on the Electoral College here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Presidents can win the popular vote and lose the Electoral College vote. It happened most recently in 2016. CNN's Electoral College Outlook showed Biden crossing the 270 threshold this week. So how does the Electoral College work again exactly? That path to 270 to win the White House, and who are the slate of electors? Do you think the Electoral College should be abolished, or do you uphold the institution? Would abolishing it lead to a constitutional crisis? We're at 800-642-1234. Ken Mayer is a political science professor at UW-Madison. Ken, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. It's good to talk to you.
Well, let's start from the very beginning. Why did the founders want to have an Electoral College? What was the impetus, the idea behind it?
There are two ideas here. The first is that the framers were deeply suspicious of popular passions, as they put it. And the Electoral College was a way of filtering that. It was an indirect way of electing a president, and which was an office that nothing had like it had ever existed before. And the idea of allowing state legislatures to specify the procedures for choosing a state's presidential electors was a way of making that indirect. The other aspect of the Electoral College that I think it is vital to make this point, that its defenders argue that it was a carefully calibrated system that was designed to balance regional versus national versus state needs, and that it was all sort of a carefully designed system to achieve those goals. And that's just wrong. It was a kludge. It was a compromise. Hmm. It was trying to figure out a way to choose this national executive to provide some independence from Congress. One of the major alternatives that the framers rejected was to simply have the House choose the president. And that was rejected because it would make the president too reliant on Congress. And this was a way of trying to create an independent executive that had some degree of popular support, but national legitimacy. So it was designed to be an indirect system.
What about the notion that the framers distrusted direct democracy?
Well, they did. We know this because the only office that was directly elected initially was the House of Representatives. The senators were chosen by state legislatures, and that was true all the way to the 17th Amendment. Looking at, among others, Hamilton's writing in the Federalist Papers and Madison's as well, that the idea of a Republican little r government is that the public would elect representatives who would make the authoritative decisions that government makes. And our notions of popular legitimacy have, of course, changed dramatically since then, with more or less a universal franchise. But the Electoral College, the structure is why five times in American history, including twice in the last 20 years, that the presidential candidate who received the most popular votes nationwide did not win the election.
Can you connect in here how slavery had to do with why we have an Electoral College?
Well, the effect of slavery was, excuse me, indirect. It was okay. More a question of how to balance the interests of large states and small states. The large states at the time, Virginia, for example, under a system of direct representation, the larger states would simply overwhelm the smaller states. And we see this in the composition of the Senate, which each state has two senators. Regardless of their population. The issue of slavery comes in because those interests were coincident with the large versus small states, and the fact that the three-fifths clause counted each enslaved person as three-fifths of a free person for the purposes of congressional apportionment, which was one of the things that made up the number of electors that each state had. So the question of whether the Electoral College was specifically designed to protect slaveholding states, certainly it was consistent with a desire to make sure that southern states were not immediately outvoted by northern states, but it was more a system that aligned with those interests rather mm-hmm. than a system that was explicitly designed to protect it.
Ken Mayer is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's giving us the history play-by-play on how the Electoral College system works and answering your questions about it at 800-642-1234. So, Ken, millions of Americans have already cast their ballots for November, but when they filled in the bubble for the presidency, they were actually voting for one of the candidates instead of they're voting for electors. Can you help us understand the elector system?
So each state has electors and a number of electors, which is equal to the number of members of the House plus two. So each state has a minimum of three. Wisconsin has eight members of the House plus two senators. So Wisconsin has 10. You add all those up, you have 435 members of the House, 100 members of the Senate. That gets you to 535. The 23rd Amendment gave the District of Columbia three Electoral College votes, 538. You need an absolute majority per the Constitution, so 270. Who are the electors? Well, you can go to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and the Republican and Democratic Party have their slates. There's one elector in each congressional district and two at large. The Constitution Party also filed a slate of electors. It doesn't matter because they're not going to win. The Libertarian Party has not filed, but basically the electors are people, the public officials, people who are prominent in the community. Mandela Barnes is
the lieutenant
governor. A member of the legislature, Sheila Stubbs, is an elector, and these people are appointed at the time of casting the vote, which is the first Monday after the second Wednesday in December. they meet at noon at the Capitol, and they cast their vote, and by law, the candidate, the party whose candidate wins the presidential elector, wins the popular vote in the state, has their electors appointed, and those are the people who vote.
So here you are with, getting into the weeds, but what happens if a state's popular vote isn't done being counted when it's time for electors to convene to vote?
Well, we have gone from the side of a gravel paved road into 15-foot tall weeds. The answer is that there is a statute, a law that was passed in 1887, the Electoral Count Act, which provides a mechanism for resolving disputes. And basically, 6 days before the day on which electors vote, which is actually the day they vote is 41 days after the election. 6 days before that, there is a deadline that if a state has certified its election and there is not a dispute over which party has won, that determination is binding on Congress. And so that's referred to as the safe harbor deadline, that if a state completes its process of appointing electors by then, Congress has to accept that.
Well, let's pause there with UW-Madison political science professor Ken Mayer. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking all things Electoral College here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Every 4 years, we pick our president through the Electoral College system. We're learning how the system works, its pros and cons, and what the Founding Fathers were thinking about in creating this process of awarding electors. What are your questions about this system? How it works? Why it exists? How have you felt in the past when the electoral and popular votes don't match up? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison political scientist Ken Mayer as our guide. So, Ken, we are hopping off there on the constitutionally established body that elects the president no more than 41 days after Election Day. So going back to that point that you were making.
So in cases where there is a dispute over who actually won the election, this goes back sort of the Electoral College has broken down a number of times, but it broke down in 1876 where there were disputes over who had actually won the election in several states, and states had submitted multiple slates of electors, it was a mess that ended only a couple of days before the inauguration, when the Samuel Tilden actually decided he would concede and would not push the matter further. And so the current procedures are a result of that dispute, which attempts to specify a method of what happens if the election is disputed and it's not clear who won. And that 6-day deadline prior to the date that the electors meet to cast their votes, if a state has resolve the dispute by then and has appointed its electors, that decision is binding on Congress, which actually ultimately is responsible for counting those votes after they are transmitted to Washington, D.C. They are opened and counted in before a joint session of Congress on January 6th of the year following the election. But of course, that doesn't resolve every dispute that might arise. If an election in Wisconsin is close enough that there is, there's a dispute as to actually who won, and it is similar to what happened in Florida in 2000, where it's close enough that a small number of ballots, a few hundred, a few dozen, maybe, might actually make the difference. And it's easy.
Chads. Uh-huh.
Well, it was not just the hanging chads in Florida, but there are also disputes over in counties that did not use the punch card system, where you can look at an image of the ballot, and sometimes there would be a candidate who looks like the voter voted for them, but then crossed it out and then voted for another candidate and wrote that candidate's name down. And so it actually can be complicated and depends on state law, how you interpret the ballot. Now, none of this is really going to matter if the election here in November, the margin is 500,000 votes or 150,000 votes. But if the election is close and it's a few thousand votes and there are disputes over absentee ballots, whether the ballot was completed correctly and the voter provided all of the information that's required on the mailed absentee ballot, I mean, it can get ugly in a real hurry, as it did in Florida in 2000.
We're talking with Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison. We're doing this deep dive on the Electoral College, how the system works, to the path to the White House. And with you, let's take a call now. Victor is joining us from West Allis. Hi, Victor.
Oh, I have a question. Didn't the Supreme Court earlier this summer rule that electoral votes have to go in accordance to the popular vote and get rid of the renegades that were out there in 2016?
So, a good question. The answer is yes. The Supreme Court in July issued a decision in a case called Cefalo versus Washington. In 2016, there were electors, Democratic electors in Washington, who did not cast their ballot for Clinton. When this happens, it's called a faithless elector. And it happens. I'll call it regularly, not routinely. That every couple of cycles or so, there can be a handful of electors from a state around the country that don't cast their electoral vote for the candidate that is certified for winning the election. Every state requires that. And they're, Maine and Nebraska are a hybrid that they have electors who vote, whose votes are decided both statewide and in each of the state's congressional district. But Washington, and I think there are 32 states that actually have a formal penalty. In Wisconsin, someone who doesn't vote for the candidate can be removed and replaced. But in a number of states, they can be fined, as they were in Washington. The state fined the faithless electors $1,000, and they sued, claiming that the Constitution does not allow states to bind electors in this way. And the Supreme Court ruled, it was actually a unanimous decision, that states can. So a state is permitted to, as Wisconsin law does, to require the electors to vote for the candidate who won the election. So that part, it's possible that we may see faithless electors in small numbers, but the ability of the state to require that is now firmly established.
Victor, thanks. Let's bring in Pete now, who is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Pete. What's your question?
Good morning, Kate and Ken. The smaller population states, such as Wyoming, Montana, the Dakotas, etc., have a slightly higher electoral college count per citizen, and that's just the nature of having two senators for every state, regardless of its size. So if we were to pursue what some might call a small state strategy, we could collect 270 electoral votes with a lot less than 50% of the U.S. population. I believe the tally is 44% of the U.S. population lives in states with 50% of the electoral college votes. And then when you think about it, well, that would be 44% of the popular vote, but we don't need the full 100% of that. We just need 51% of that 44%. So what I'm illustrating, and I'm looking for some feedback on it, is the percentage of the popular vote that one could have and still win the election is very small. It could actually be as small as half of 44% or 22%. So I'm looking for some comments on that extreme possibility for abuse of the Electoral College. Thanks.
Well, yeah, theoretically, that's possible, and it actually could be smaller than that if turnout is lower. And generally, a presidential candidate who, say, gets 55% of the vote actually is getting probably closer to 25% of the vote or 28% of the vote, because turnout at its highest is, you know, generally going to be about 50% of 55% of the eligible population. And it is absolutely true that small states have a disproportionate weight. Wyoming has three electoral college votes. It's got a population of roughly 800,000. So it's one elector for every 270,000 people. California has 55 electoral college votes and a population of about 40 million. So it has one elector for every 900,000 people or so, or 800,000 people. So that's clearly right. What makes it somewhat more important is that as parties have sorted themselves out over the past few decades, that rural states and smaller states, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, and so forth, that they tend to be Republican. And so this provides a bit of a geographic advantage to Republican presidential candidates, because if you win Wyoming by 1,000 votes, or actually Republicans tend to do better than that, it's somewhat easier for Republican candidates to run up the electoral college count in those states than it is for Democratic candidates, where some of the large states, California with 55, New York, I think, has 29. So does Florida. But you know, California, New York, Illinois tend to be safe Democratic states, but with fewer large states in their column, it can be somewhat easier for Democratic candidates to get more votes, but that doesn't necessarily translate into Electoral College wins. And so the last two times that the popular vote and the electoral vote diverged, it worked to the benefit of the Republican candidate. So that clearly can happen.
UW-Madison political science professor Ken Mayer is our guide to the Electoral College. He's fielding everything you ever wanted to ask about the system. Do you think the Electoral College should be abolished, or do you uphold the vision of what the framers put in place? Are you okay with how the division goes between big states and small states? What do you think is the best explanation for it? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. It's an hour on the Electoral College here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is a deep dive, a civics brush up, if you will, into what the framers set up for us. A recent Gallup poll found 3 in 5 Americans support abolishing the Electoral College and replacing it with a popular vote system. Gallup found that this preference for electing the president based on who received the most votes nationwide is driven largely by Democrats and independents. Far fewer Republicans share this view. So what's your take on the Electoral College? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison political scientist Ken Mayer, who's our guide to the system, and he stays with us. Let's take another call now. Gary is joining us from Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Since on November 3rd, I'm voting for an elector or electors, why do their names not appear on the ballot?
Well, that's a good question. That there have been states, even through the 1960s, where instead of the presidential candidate, it was actually the specific electors that you were casting a ballot for. Under Wisconsin state law, a vote for the candidate is considered identical to a vote for that party's electors. So there really isn't a meaningful legal distinction because those are considered to be the same thing. The issue with voting for the electors that you take a look at the list of the slates that were filed with the Wisconsin Election Commission, I think of the 20. 10 in each party, I think I recognized maybe 5 names. And if the electors themselves were on the ballot rather than the candidates, I think that would be far more confusing.
Gary, thanks. You know, Ken, are there any upsides to direct election, to counting voters equally?
Well, so the issue with deciding the race by the popular vote is that's the one that's most consistent with what we would consider to be foundational representational rules, that in an election, the candidate that is preferred by the most voters is the one who it would seem should win the election. And the Electoral College, when there is a divergence, it seems like an anti-democratic little d outcome. The justifications for the Electoral College are we set aside the partisan implications of that. The arguments are that it forces candidates to campaign broadly rather than just in large states. Uh-huh. That it is important to represent state level interests, and it recognizes the role of the states in our federal system, but that's not how it works in practice. It's not a big state versus small state divergence. Where candidates spend virtually all of their time is in competitive states, where it's close enough that candidate effort, advertising, appearances, mobilization could actually flip the state from one candidate to the other. You know, right now, all of the polls and forecasting models, Biden is going to win California by probably 30 to 35 points, that there is essentially zero chance that Trump is going to win California. Similarly, there's virtually zero chance that Biden is going to win Arkansas, Oklahoma, West Virginia. And so if you look at where candidates advertise, where they spend their time, their visits, where they devote resources, there is an overwhelming bias in small states. So, you know, there will be more advertising in Nevada or New Hampshire than there will be in California and Texas combined. This year doesn't quite follow that because there are more states that are competitive. Even Texas might be in play. If you really kind of drill down and take a look at the purported justifications for the Electoral College, they really no longer hold up to much real scrutiny. The justifications that are offered, they just don't carry the weight that they are intended or purported to. And a lot of the arguments in favor of it rely on the premise that it was a carefully constructed, nuanced, and calibrated system. And it was not. I mean, it was a compromise, it was a kludge, and it broke down almost immediately. The first presidential election was in 1788. By 1800, the Electoral College system had broken down completely. That's where you had a tie between Jefferson and Burr, which led to the 12th Amendment, which changed the system to recognize the role of parties. And so in my view, it really is an anachronism that doesn't fulfill the purposes that it was intended to fulfill or that it is purported to fulfill.
We're talking with Ken Mayer, who's a political science professor at UW-Madison, as we explore the Electoral College system, its history, how it works today, with your questions at 800-642-1234. We heard from Scott in New Berlin, called in, couldn't stay with us, but wanted to say Scott thinks the Electoral College is the way it is, but thinks instead of winning by an entire state, you could do it by congressional district. But Scott says this would have to be done state by state.
Right. So it's an excellent point that the procedure for allocating a state's Electoral College votes under the Constitution is entirely delegated to state legislatures. There actually is not a formal requirement that a state actually hold an election, that it is conceivable that a state could revert back to having the state legislature select the presidential electors.
Huh.
Most states, 48 states, have a winner-take-all system where you win California by one vote, you get all 55 votes. You win Texas by two votes, you get all of Texas's 38 votes. Changing it to a district-based system would turn it in, take California, for example, turn it into a single winner-take-all to 55 or 53, or actually 54 winner-take-all districts, one in each congressional district and two statewide. You can't separate that from the partisan implications. So if you look at California's congressional delegation, California currently has 45 Democrats and 7 Republicans. So if California went from a statewide to a congressional district race, that would probably mean, assuming the presidential vote was reflected the congressional vote, California would go from 55 Democratic votes to 47 Democratic votes and 7 or 8 Republican votes. And so that means that would provide an advantage to Republicans because they would pick up votes that they otherwise wouldn't. The opposite would be true in Texas. Texas's delegation, so I'm looking at the figures here, Texas has 23 Republicans and 13 Democrats. So if you change that to a district-based system, you would have Democrats picking up. Now, there's no way that a Democratic legislature in California is going to go to a district-based system, because that would benefit Republicans. And there's no way that Texas is going to go to a district-based system, because that would benefit Democrats. And even, you know, states like, you know, heavily Republican states, that, you know, there are some states where the congressional delegations are uniform. Arkansas is all Republican. Mm-hmm. New Mexico is all Democratic. But in every state where you would have a split, it would benefit the party that would lose the statewide vote but would pick up a couple of congressional seats. And so that's one way of making sure, or increasing the likelihood, that the Electoral College vote reflects the popular vote. But that there's just no way that
you would be all states, inside out and upside down.
Yeah, I mean, you would have to do it nationally. And the only way to do that would be amending the Constitution. And if you're proposing an amendment to the Constitution to deal with that, I think most opponents of the Electoral College would say, you know, you might as well go all in and get rid of it altogether and just decide the presidential election based on the nationwide popular vote, which itself has some problems, because that there are things that you would have to do in order to make sure that worked.
Well, Bob in New Berlin couldn't stay, but wants to know, Ken, if the Electoral College system works as it's supposed to work and the president passes away before the inauguration, who is sworn into office, Bob asks.
Okay. Well, it's a good question.
This show is called Stump the Political Scientist, by the way.
Yeah, I can't remember what election it was. It might have been 1872 or 1880, where one of the candidates, not the winner, but one of the losing candidate, the presidential candidate, actually died after the election and before the Electoral College votes were cast. And so if that happens, you know, you votes cast for someone who has died is not counted. So there are three phases here. That if a presidential candidate wins but dies between the election and the count, there are procedures to replacing that candidate, but it gets nightmarishly murky in a real hurry.
UW-Madison political science professor Ken Mayer is giving us perspective on this complex system of our Electoral College and the path to the White House. You can still join in, still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ken Mayer here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with UW-Madison political scientist Ken Mayer. We're taking this long look at the Electoral College, its shortcomings, its valuable purpose, and what happened when the Founding Fathers were faced with a tough decision of deciding the election process, the path to the White House. Let's take another call now. Jeff is joining us in Wausau. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Great conversation. I love this kind of stuff. So my comment is this. In the absence of a moral imperative, the typical voter is going to vote for the things that benefit them the most. So moral imperative would be, say, for example, the abortion argument. Whichever side you're on, you morally think is the correct one, you might be willing to overlook your personal gain to vote for the candidate that most aligns with that moral imperative. Now, if you're not so demanding on that, then you're going to vote for the things that benefit you. So if you have a group of individuals that's much larger, such as public employees, which makes up a vast majority of the workforce, compared to the farmers, which is a much smaller minority, the democracy will actually crush the farming system, because the vast majority of voting will go towards the individuals that will self-gain through their vote, which might not take into account the farmers. And that's why the Electoral College is so important to me, is because that balances out that farmer's vote. Even though they're not in that vast majority, they can still have some say in how the future looks for them as well.
Jeff, thank you for that. Ken?
So this is the, an argument in favor of the Electoral College is that it protects the rights of political minorities. And there are a number of such mechanisms in the Constitution, equal representation in the Senate for election, for example. You know, one of the difficulties with that argument is that it assumes, it's basically premised on the assumption that voters are, that someone in Wisconsin or a farmer in Wisconsin and someone who's not a farmer in Wisconsin have divergent interests, or that those distinctions are basically discrete by state. Well, if you look at the states with the largest agriculture industries, the state that has, you know, has the largest agriculture production is California. And it's not, the difficulty is that voters are sovereign, right? Voters are allowed to decide how they're going to allocate, what the basis of their vote is, whether it was the collar's moral imperative or self-interest. And there are a number of mechanisms that already protect that. But it also is based on the premise that the interest of a we'll call it a bloc, we'll call it an interest group, although even though that's not quite what I think the caller meant, important sectors maybe, that it assumes that protecting that sector is in the public interest. And I think with something like farming, you know, you can certainly make that case.
You can
that
make
it's
a case for it,
especially in Wisconsin. But why, you know, why farmers and not cities, or why farmers and not automobile manufacturers? One of the foundations of a pluralistic system is that it is supposed to reflect all of that through things like congressional representation, that members who represent farming districts, well, that's a mechanism. The Senate is structured so that Wyoming and Wisconsin get the same number of senators as a state that doesn't have a large farming or doesn't have a definable interest like that. So it is certainly an argument in favor of the Electoral College, but it's kind of begging the question, is that it is assuming that the answer assumes the correctness of the underlying premises, when that's kind of endogenous or internal to the political system.
Ken Mayer is a political science professor at UW-Madison. He's taking us on a tour of the Electoral College system and its complexity. Let's bring in Joanne now in Neshkoro. Hi, Joanne.
Hello. I'm definitely in favor of just abolishing the Electoral College, because the last 4 years, the popular vote was overruled by Electoral College, and, you know, the one that lost the popular vote won the presidency. But I would be in favor of proportional electorates, you know, so if you get 53% of the votes, you get a little over half the electoral votes and so forth. The idea that assigning electoral colleges by district, Senate district or representative district, whatever, in states that are heavily gerrymandered, like Wisconsin, where I think the numbers are, last year we got, the Democrats got about 64% of the votes, but only 34% of representation in the House and Assembly, in the Senate and House, I mean, because of gerrymandering. So we have to end gerrymandering before we do something like that.
Joanne, thanks for the call. What do you see there, Ken?
Well, the caller's right that in a state where congressional districts are drawn in a way that is intended to benefit one political party, and this happened in Wisconsin, it happened in Maryland where the Democrats did it. So the congressional districts are not this sort of external magic thing that happens. And so it would provide even more of an incentive to try to draw districts in a way that would benefit the party controlling the legislature. The simplest in theory, because it turns out it's actually not quite as simple as that, would be a national popular vote. The issue with that is that the ability to vote, or the sort of the structure of voting rights and qualifications, are very different around the country. There are some states, I mean, we're having this dispute or this controversy over absentee voting and whether absentee votes need to have a witness signature, as in South Carolina, or whether you even have the right to a no-excuse absentee, which you don't have in states like Texas or Mississippi. And so when you have different voting rules in each of the 50 states, you could still have a problem that the national vote, when you sum up all of that across the country, well, it's reflecting different things. And so it's not quite as simple as saying popular vote, we're done, easy peasy.
Walk away, right.
It's complicated.
Yeah, Ken, and we're short on time, but I want to ask Richard in Oconomowoc's question to you. And Richard is wondering, you know, who decides whether we have the Electoral College or whether we get rid of it? Where does that decision lie?
Well, it would lie in the mechanisms for amending the Constitution, which would either be a 2/3 vote in both the House and the Senate, and then ratified by 38 states, or it would be a constitutional convention. You know,
is there an appetite for that?
There is. I mean, the public would support it, but it would take more than that. It would have to be something overwhelming, that something that could get 2/3 support in both the House and the Senate. And that seems unlikely, or a national constitutional convention, which is possible, but that has its own risks. And no matter how you do it, it's going to be very, very tough.
Ken, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. I love doing these shows where we can, you know, have a long conversation. Love hearing from callers. So this has been great. So thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much. Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison. Just ahead, it is 1A. Stay with us. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.